Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Jack Chanik has been reading tarot since he was 11 years old and has been publicly writing about tarot since 2015. He has taught workshops on tarot, Kabbalah, and Wicca around the country, as well as presenting at festivals such as Free Spirit Gathering and Llewellyn Con. He is the author of Kabbalah for Wiccans and Tarot for Real Life. His new book, Queen of All Witcheries, A Biography of the Goddess, is out from Llewellyn in June 2023. He lives in New Jersey, where he works as an academic philosopher specializing in Immanuel Kant's philosophy of science. Jack Chanik, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being on. I can't wait to dive into your book because it's super awesome. But our first question for everybody on the show is why write? Why write books?
Why write? Because I am terminally incapable of shutting up is the honest answer. No, I like to think about things, and particularly with sort of witchcraft and tarot and esoteric topics, I like to take the time to think really deeply about them and try to approach them from multiple angles. Mm. And really and truly, I write more for my own benefit than for everyone else's, because I find that it's easiest for me to get my thoughts in order if I lay them out in an outline and actually write them out in long form. The easiest way for me to know what I think is to write it down.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's not the most common answer, but I think it is one of the common things that people say is that, you know, we write to figure out kind of what we think about a topic. And I would imagine like your work, your vocation is as a philosopher. So I assume it's hard to separate that from like your witchcraft and your practice and your writing and all that as well.
You know, it's easier than you might think, because the philosophy that I work on the history of philosophy. I work on 18th century German metaphysics, which is very, you know, like this is at a point in history where the Enlightenment is sort of coming into being. You have this very like materialistic, secular orientation toward philosophy, toward science. And so a lot of the things that I'm writing about really have no esoteric bent to them whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So they're interesting. They're fun to work on. I enjoy looking at those things. But they touch on my witchcraft a lot less than I think a lot of people would expect that they would, just because the fundamental orientation of these 18th century thinkers is so radically different from my own.
Yeah.
You know, you have people here who are starting from a very stripped down and secular worldview, which, you know, there are hints of Christianity floating in the background, but these are really people who are looking to provide a scientific materialist account of how the world works, how we can understand ethics and freedom and so on. And those are just very different starting points than the starting points I have when I'm writing about things like reading tarot cards or goddesses or, you know.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I do like, it is interesting to me though, that, you know, in studying the history of philosophy, like, cause I think one of the things about approaching your book, like I kind of went in like with no expectations. Cause I just kind of wanted to see how the book was going to be built. Right. Because calling something a biography of the goddess is like, it could be many things, right? Like you could approach this a lot of different ways. So I love that what you've done is kind of a history of the thought of how we think about the goddess. So in a way, it does kind of make sense with me that that's kind of your approach in philosophy.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can certainly see there's something in the methodology. There's something in the way that I approach thinking about these things that imports the way that I'm used to thinking about the history of philosophy, where it's a matter of like, what are the ideas? What are the practices here? And how did they develop over time?
Yeah.
I sometimes joke that the alternate title for this book should be Tricking Pagans into Reading History. because it, you know, like we want to read books that are about practice, that are about like how we can do things, how we can structure our rituals or our magic or whatever. And I think personally, for me, the history is a really important part of that. Mm-hmm. It's an important part of understanding what I'm doing and why. But history is not sexy, and most people don't think that they want to read history unless you like pull a bit of a bait and switch with them. And then it turns out the history is actually incredibly interesting and people like it, but you have to sort of get a foot in the door.
Yeah. It's funny. And people, when they hear this, will have hopefully heard the episodes with Phoenix LaFay, talking about like, we're both kind of in a place in our practice where we really do want to know the history. Like that's the most important. That's like the most interesting thing, is to kind of go back and read these foundational texts and, you know, what people thought and how we got to where we are now, like the good and bad of how we got to where we are now. And one of the things I do really like about the book, and this is a conversation I've been having like personally, and for some reason it shows up a lot on the podcast too, because I suspect it's a little bit in the zeitgeist, but is that whether or not these early thinkers like Leland, like Murray, like, whether or not they were right is kind of irrelevant.
Completely. Completely.
It's you know, it's the foundational myths of modern paganism, basically. And that those don't have to have historical academic proof for people's, how people interact with things. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because I love that that's really like the underpinning of this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So for people who are listening who have not yet read the book, the idea behind this book is to understand the modern history of the goddess and of goddess worship. So who were the thinkers, the practitioners, the movements that allowed goddess worship as we know it today to come into the world? Because when we think about the goddess, you know, there's sort of a very particular figure that we think about. She's a moon goddess, she's a mother goddess, she's associated with magic and so on. And she's not exactly like any goddess in the ancient world. You know, there are goddesses in the ancient world who have some features in common with her, but there's no goddess anywhere in antiquity that you can point to and be like, ah, yes, that's the exact same goddess that we talk about when we talk about the goddess in scare quotes today. So where did this goddess come from? And the idea behind the book is to sort of set aside questions of ancient paganism and just think about the development of modern goddess worship, this new thing that exists in the world starting from like the mid-19th century up to the present day. And what you see with a lot of the texts that influenced and allowed for the development of contemporary goddess worship is the influence of scholars, anthropologists, historians, folklorists who were coming up with ideas about what ancient paganism might have been like, about what ancient witchcraft might have been like. And as scholarship has continued to update over the course of the past 150 years, we now have a better sense of what ancient religion was like in various respects. And we know a lot of the ways in which those scholars were wrong in the historical claims that they made. But the relationship between the present and the past is this complicated and messy thing. So just because they were wrong about some of these things doesn't mean that their ideas weren't important or significant or in some sense poetically or divinely inspired. So you have people who are coming up with ideas about what ancient goddess worship might have been. And even though we now know that's not what ancient goddess worship was like, it shaped the way that people thought about what goddess worship could be and how that came into the modern world. Mm-hmm. So just as an example, you have Sir James Frazer, who writes The Golden Bough, which is this massive tome that tries to provide a unified theory of all of world mythology. And so much of what Frazer said was wrong, right? Like, Frazer is not taken seriously as a scholar anymore. But everyone in the 19th century who read Frazer went, oh yeah, this is good stuff. And they took those ideas and applied those ideas in building their new goddess religions. And so there's this weird thing where we're sort of in this juncture between an imagined pagan past and the construction of a pagan future. And those two things can sort of come apart from each other. Mm-hmm. So just because the imagined pagan past turns out not to be historically accurate doesn't mean that the ideas that it presents didn't have significance, importance, or beauty for the creation of that pagan future. Right. So a lot of the ideas that we see in figures like James Frazer or any of the other figures I discuss in the book, these are ideas that became incredibly important for the formation of goddess religion as we know it today. And it doesn't really matter that they're new or that they're not historically accurate, because they're still important and powerful, right? Like we have built a new mythology for ourselves, and that mythology isn't made less legitimate just because it's new.
Right. I do think one of the things I think is interesting in looking at it, the way it's laid out in the book, I really like how you kind of show how they build on each other, these ideas come from the original German writer whose name I will not try to pronounce. I'll let you pronounce. and that's built it up. One thing I do think is interesting is, aside from Margaret Murray and Doreen Valiente, like so many of these people were men who still had these very reductionist, essentialist ideas about gender. And I feel like, we are at the point in the evolution of modern paganism where we're really starting to get past that. But I'm just curious, do you have thoughts about why that was so much a part of it?
Yeah, so many of the figures who contributed important ideas in the development of goddess religion turn out to have been men. And that's a shocking and bizarre thing for a contemporary religious movement that focuses so much on feminism, on women's voices, on women's power. But a lot of it has to do with who had power over the course of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, who had access to a platform. So lots of people were thinking about these things, writing about these things. Jane Ellen Harrison was one of the Cambridge ritualists. She did a lot of really interesting sort of classical work on what ancient Greek religion had been like. There was an author named Jessie Weston who took a lot of inspiration from James Frazer, and she wrote about King Arthur and the Grail legend. So there were women doing really important work that also contributed to this milieu. But a lot of the names that get remembered, a lot of the names that get cited, a lot of the names that are considered the most influential turn out to be men. And that's simply because in the 19th century and through most of the 20th century, men were the ones who had power. Men were the ones whose voices were considered important. Men were the ones who had access to the resources to spend their time on researching, writing, and publishing. And men were taken more seriously than women, even when they were doing comparable work. It's really interesting to think about the way that a feminist religion has emerged in the 20th and 21st centuries that has roots, at least in part, in male scholars, or not even just scholars, but also, magical practitioners, mm-hmm. but in men doing this work and shaping ideas about what the goddess would be like, what goddess worship would be like. The German scholar, I think he might actually have been Swiss, but the scholar that you mentioned, his name is mm-hmm. Johann Jakob Bachofen. And Bachofen was sort of one of the founders of anthropology. And he had this whole idea that ancient civilization had been matriarchal. It had been run by women. Families had been organized around motherhood rather than around fatherhood. And then eventually there had been a patriarchal takeover that had led to the rise of Christianity. And this is a narrative that became so widespread, particularly in 20th century goddess feminism. But the way that Bachofen actually talked about it, ancient matriarchy, the matriarchy that he imagined, wasn't actually all that great. Right? He saw it as a primitive and bad thing, and he thought it was good that men had taken over and allowed for the advancement of society. And then as goddess religion starts to emerge more and more in the modern world, and as people are drawing on this myth of this imagined matriarchal past, what you see is people taking that idea that originates not only with a man, but with a fairly sort of anti-feminist and regressive view of gender and gender roles and the place that women should occupy in society. you see people taking that very sort of antiquated view and reimagining it as something that fits in with a feminist religion, where all of a sudden this ancient matriarchy is a good thing, is the origin of civilization, is a time of sort of utopian peace before the creation of war and patriarchal oppression. And so these narratives are just constantly shifting and changing as we take ideas and look back to the past and reinterpret the past through the lens of the present. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 20, 30 years down the line, we go back and we do that same process all over again. And the ideas inherent in goddess religion and the ways we relate to those ideas are constantly shifting as our own society is changing. And we're looking back at the past and at these ideas, even though they originate largely with men. Mm-hmm. It's a really fascinating and complicated and thorny thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting that kind of flipping of what their intention was is not the first or last time that happens, that continues. Like, oh no, our goal was to set out to show you the foibles of Christianity and how it's just based on older stuff and also wrong. And let's just not be religious. And they're like, oh no, we're going to run with this.
Yeah. Right. So the Golden Bough is a great example of this, where James Frazer was an atheist and wrote the Golden Bough pretty explicitly to try to discredit Christianity. He was like, look, Christianity is terrible because it's actually just repackaged paganism. And then along come the pagans and they're like, oh, wait, we like that repackaged paganism. Let's just all be pagans. And that's the exact opposite of what Frazer would have wanted, right? He would have seen that as going backward. But you have people who are building these new religious movements and reinterpreting what all these authors are saying in a way that fits with the new religious paradigm they're creating. And I think that's super cool.
Yeah. It makes me think of the discovery of witches, like the same thing. Like I'm going to document all this stuff to show you that it's bunk. And then witches will later use it to reproduce spells. So, like, oops, that was not what you intended. But I think that's such an important thing to point out, is that no matter how we look at these texts and the history of the evolution of goddess worship, our lens is always changing too. And I think that is something that, I don't know, I've said this so many times in the show that I just hate the idea that we think that these things are trapped in amber or museum pieces. Like, this is a living tradition that is growing and changing, like living traditions continue to do as long as they are practiced, right? And to just say, no, this is the end point. That's how you kill something, I think.
Yeah. Well, and not only is it a living tradition that's continuing to change, but it's in very early days, mm-hmm. right? Like, wherever you want to trace the start of modern goddess worship, we're still less than 200 years old. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a very new, very young religion. And of course it's continuing to change. And of course we keep looking back at our own past and reimagining that past and then taking the past and moving it forward into the future. And this constant interplay between where we've been and where we are and where we're going, that is never going to stop, because that's just how religious communities evolve, right? Mm-hmm. You still see similar things like that happening even in religions that have been around for a couple thousand years. Yeah. Like that relationship between the present and the past is constantly changing because it depends on who we are in the present. So as we change, our relationship to our past will also always change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that should be like underlined and bold and highlighted in bright yellow. But so one of the things, like, I love your approach to this. Like I said, that like the building, the layers of like, this is kind of where things start. And then, you know, obviously I'm sure you left a lot on the table because there's just so much information out there. But one of the things I really liked about the book is that every chapter about this new like text or thinker also starts with your personal experience to really tie what you're talking about into the now. And I just kind of wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that and kind of your approach to like what to share, because I feel like it's such a key to unlocking why this history matters to me.
Yeah, it's I think it's very easy to feel like the history, when we're talking about the history of goddess worship, or even just history in general, right? Like the same thing when I'm working on the history of philosophy. It's easy to feel like history is something that lives in the past and it's dead and it doesn't affect us now. And actually, it's entirely the opposite, where for me at least, discovering history, discovering where things came from, helps me to relate to what I'm doing now. And so as I was working through the book in each chapter, I'm thinking about, like, what are the ideas that came out of this piece of goddess history? What are the important, you know, rituals or theological perspectives or magical pieces that came out of this? And how do those exist in my connection to the goddess now? So in, you know, one place I talk about visiting a witchcraft museum and sort of the idea of the connection between a goddess and witches and witch trials in the early modern period. What does that all mean? And like, when did I first encounter any of those ideas and how did they shape my relationship to the goddess? I talk about the first time I cast a spell. I talk about certain rituals that I've participated in, or, you know, there's a Temple of Isis in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Mm-hmm. And I talk about the experience for me of going to that temple and worshiping the goddess in that temple. And all of these are things that have a context to them. So I'm not just going to the Temple of Isis and worshiping the goddess for funsies. I'm doing it because in the history of modern goddess worship, there's been this deep connection drawn between the goddess and the goddess Isis. Mm-hmm. Those are figures who are very closely related to each other, at least in 20th century thinking. Mm-hmm. And so what does it mean to me to be able to go to a temple of Isis and do this? Well, it means that I'm drawing on this historical connection that was put in place by figures like Dion Fortune and Aleister Crowley and so on. So every personal experience that I have with the goddess connects me to the history. And conversely, every piece of history that I'm picking up as I work through trying to understand how this thing came into the world is connecting me back to my own personal experiences. And so when I shared these experiences in the book, you know, I'm not just trying to tell personal stories for the sake of it. I'm trying to show the reader that this history has an inherently personal dimension. Mm-hmm. And there's an implicit invitation there for someone reading through the book to find connections to their own stories. So to read this chapter on Aleister Crowley and think, okay, how does this connect to my experiences with the goddess, right? If I were going to write a story of my own to put at the start of this chapter, what story would it be? How does my relationship to the goddess connect to this history? And how does the history inform my relationship to the goddess? That's the real hope.
Right. Well, and I think one of the things that shows too is that whether or not you know about these things, are cognizant, or I think even care, honestly, there's no way to unpick them from modern practice. Like, I don't particularly like how Crowley presented himself as a human in the world. I also cannot deny the fact that his thinking greatly affected the modern occult movement. There's no way to unpick those. And so I think it's like, especially in occult spaces where we talk about, you know, ancestor veneration and necromancy and all of those kind of things, like these are your ancestors of ideas. Like, it's important to kind of know who these people are. And also to understand that, you know, they, at the end of the day, they were people with foibles and sometimes really problematic views about things. You know, like, here's the good stuff that they presented, but also let's be realistic about, these people are not saints, or we don't need to write hagiographies of them. We can talk about them as people who had ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. And another sort of similar to wrestling with how many of these influential figures were men, we also have to understand that a lot of these figures were deeply invested in the project of colonialism. A lot of them had really nasty views about race. They had, you know, all kinds of views that we don't endorse now, that we don't want to endorse, that we can understand are bad. And that doesn't mean that you have to throw out everything that they ever said, because honestly, if you do that, you don't have any goddess worship left. But it means that we approach them with a critical eye and talk about what were the ideas that they had, where did these ideas come from, and how do we untangle the good things about the ideas, the valuable things about the ideas, from the things that are embedded in a historical context that no longer applies to us, or from the things that are the product of individual biases or you know, prejudices, or just from the things that don't serve us anymore. So, you know, like a classic example of this is Gerald Gardner, one of the founding figures of Wicca, was very homophobic. You know, we have testimony from Lois Byrne, one of the high priestesses who worked closely with him, where she said, like, Gerald was a great guy. We all loved him. He really didn't like gay people. That doesn't mean that all of goddess worship after Gardner has to be homophobic, because he was one person and he had flaws. Right. And we can take his contributions to goddess worship and leave the homophobia on the table.
Yeah. Well, and I think you do a good job of pointing to the things like, you know, kind of this, the extractive quality of people who wanted to look at, you know, especially British writers who were looking at places in the empire that they wanted to extract that knowledge and somehow cleanse it of its Orientalism, which is such a gross concept, and bring that, you know, bring the good home and leave all this primitive whatever they thought about it behind. And now I think, you know, I feel like that's something that, you know, current people, witches, occult practitioners, magicians, whatever label you want to use, you know, it's something we are having to examine.
Yeah, significantly.
And I think about that. I mean, you've written about Kabbalah, so you know this. You know, like, where these bodies are too. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a really significant thing. And especially with some of the occult practitioners at the turn of the century, you see this desire to, as you say, extract the wisdom of the Orient. The idea that non-Western societies have some privileged, spooky, mystical access to occult truths that has been lost in the West, and that therefore the best thing we can do is to steal all of their religious and esoteric practices, whitewash them, and present them as European. And that, like, that's the way that we're going to achieve mystical truth. Which, saying it now in the year 2023, that's a terrible idea. Not only because it's culturally insensitive and it's exploitative and it's racist, like all of those things, all of those social considerations are very much in place and very much matter, but also because it's just a bad way to try to gain knowledge, right? If you try to take something completely out of its context, strip away everything that makes it unique and then present it as your own, you're not going to learn anything. You're not going to accomplish anything. No. But like, that doesn't mean that the people who were working on these things didn't have anything interesting or valuable to say. It just means that we have to be really attentive to that stuff going on in the background whenever we read through their work. And we have to ask ourselves, okay, how much of this is coming from this colonialist project? And how much of this is sort of a genuine, actionable, religious or magical insight that we can take and apply to what we're doing today?
I'm curious, in reading these texts and spending time with them, you know, kind of with a deeper dive, not just reading them, but really looking at them in context of writing the book. Like, what surprised you? Were there things that surprised you?
Yeah. So one of the things that surprised me, we've already talked about, was just how many men there were. Intellectually, I had sort of probably known that. But actually sitting down with the texts and just looking at the list of names and being like, ooh, wow, not a whole lot of women going on here, was surprising to me and really took me aback. And again, that's not to say that women weren't doing important work in this time, because there were a lot of women who were doing really extraordinary work. But because men had more resources, more of a platform, an easier time doing this work and getting their names out there, a lot of the time, the men are the names that get remembered. Mm-hmm. One of the other things I think that really surprised me was as I was working through this narrative trajectory that I created, where, you know, I start in 1861 with Bachofen, and then I work up through the goddess feminism movement that starts in second wave feminism in like the 1970s. There were two goddess names that kept cropping up. And those goddesses were Isis and Diana. And over and over and over again, as I was reading through these texts and looking at the things that people were saying about the goddess, about goddess worship, about the goddesses they were drawing from in antiquity, the names Isis and Diana kept coming back. And so I said, you know, at the start of a conversation that there's really no one goddess in the ancient world who's exactly like the goddess that we know today. But there are two who, if you sort of put them together, you more or less get the goddess that we know today. And I think that understanding the goddess, in, you know, this is an oversimplification, but if you think about the goddess of contemporary goddess worship, whether that's goddess feminism or Wicca or, you know, any of the other permutations on goddess religion that exist today, if we think about that figure kind of as Isis plus Diana, that really goes a very long way toward helping to explain on a very basic level who this goddess is and what she's all about. And I was really struck by that as I was doing the research for this book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was an interesting thread for me too, of like, well, and just, you know, because I came to paganism, Wicca, I probably came to Wicca, you know, because it was late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, Diana, and Isis really were who people talked about. Or it was also that like weird pick and mix phase of paganism where you would just be like, well, I'm going to do a love spell, so I'm going to call an Aphrodite instead of like establishing a relationship with this person. This very soft polytheist approach to paganism. But yeah, it's, I thought that was really fascinating too, that, you know, like, and I think part of that, you're right, is that because they are kind of building on each other's ideas. So of course, but they also pull from different parts, largely the Mediterranean. I mean, I feel like that's really where a lot of this stuff comes, you know, these British writers were really pulling from the Near East for them. So it's, that is kind of interesting to you, but.
Yeah. No, it absolutely is the case that a lot of these British writers were really interested in classical antiquity. They were interested mm-hmm. in ancient Greece, ancient Egypt, and Rome, and the societies around the Mediterranean. And that's where they were drawing a lot of inspiration from. And you see a little bit of like some people who were interested in the pagan religions of the ancient British Isles. Robert Graves, for example, is really interested in Welsh mythology. But for the most part, the names that people are drawing from, the myths that people are drawing from, are coming from the ancient Mediterranean. Which, like, that then leads you into this whole question about the legacy of classical antiquity and the way that that got sort of co-opted by the British Empire. Which continues even up to this day, right? There is still a raging debate over the Parthenon marbles, right, which were taken by Lord Elgin and now reside in the British Museum. And the Greek government for years and years and years and said, hey, this is an important part of our national history. Can we have it back? And the British Museum is like, no, it's an important part of our national history. What are you talking about?
Our national history of thievery.
So this idea that, you know, ancient Mediterranean religion sort of got co-opted as part of the project of building paganism in Northwestern Europe is itself this interesting kind of weird and difficult thing that touches on a lot of the colonial legacy of 19th century Britain in general. And I think that, like, the more you sit with this history, the more clear that becomes.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You brought up Graves, and I think about, I have been on this small rabbit hole for a project I'm working on about how C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and all these people, a lot of their fantasy of the world comes from the horror of World War One, this reaction to that. And then Graves kind of has that same reaction to World War II. And part of that is where the White Goddess comes from. And I just think about that interesting approach is again, it's this essentializing the feminine as somehow different than destructive, and ignoring that, in other parts where they haven't quite destructive goddesses are part of the ancient world outside this purview that they're looking at. And they really essentialize, again, the feminine and women in this idea as this direct counterpoint to the horrors of basically early 20th century war.
Yeah, there's, this starts with Bachofen. From the outset, people who are talking about modern goddess worship are saying things like, the goddess is sweet and loving and kind and gentle and artistic, and she's not warlike or industrial or, any of these bad things that we're associating with the horrors of modernity. And that's because the goddess is a woman and women aren't aggressive. And there is this reductive view of gender that just makes you want to put your hands over your face. But it's weird because on the one hand, we look at that now, with a 21st century understanding of gender, and we're that's absolute nonsense. Of course, women have the same range of emotional complexity that men have, because why on earth wouldn't they? But it's also weirdly proto-feminist for the time in which these things were written. So even though figures like Robert Graves are drawing on this silly and reductive idea of women and goddesses as being inherently sweet and mild and timid, at the same time, Robert Graves is saying hey, there's something really deeply wrong with our society if World War II was able to happen. There's clearly a deep, deep problem here. And maybe that problem comes in part from the way that women have no power in our society. So even though he's working with this warped conception of gender that we would no longer find in any way acceptable, he's still saying something that for the year 1948 is extraordinarily progressive, where he's saying hey, guys, patriarchy is doing a lot of damage here. And I think that's this really interesting thing that comes out of looking back at pagan history and being able to say, as flawed as these people were, their ideas were important and their ideas really were driving religion forward and driving toward a lot of the ideals that we hold today, even though they were constrained by the biases of their time and often expressed themselves in language that we would now consider incredibly regressive or backward or in other ways unacceptable.
Yeah, I do like this idea of, slow progress through, slow progress is not fun to sit through. But when you look at history, that's generally how things have changed and continued to change, is through this progress. But and that is also kind of reductive too, but it's, we do black slide, let's not kid ourselves. But yeah, it's one of these topics that I think, I feel like whoever picks up this book, whether they got tricked into reading about history or not, you leave with, an excessive amount of things added to your to be read pile if you haven't delved into some of these texts. And if someone picks this up, and you're okay, I want to read some of this, where would you tell someone to start as an entry point? Because I feel like some of these texts are the Golden Bough. No one's ready to sit down and read 5,000 pages. No one's really ready for that. So where would you tell people to start if they want to look at one of these seminal texts, I guess?
So I would tell people to start with Aradia, the Gospel of the Witches by Charles Godfrey Leland. It's a short little book. It's in the public domain, so you can read it for free online. You don't even have to buy a book. And it is easy to read. It's interesting. There's a lot of really cool witchcraft in there. There are a lot of like really interesting spells in there. I think one of the spells is a spell to like have books be on sale so that you can buy them cheaply when you go to the market, which is a fantastic spell that we should all be using all the time. but it's this beautiful, easy to read, accessible little text. It has a lot of interesting things to say about the goddess, about ideas of witchcraft. And yeah, that's definitely like the easiest and most fun point of entry, I think, to reading these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Another, I think, really good entry point is The Sea Priestess by Dionne Fortune. This is one of Dionne Fortune's occult novels. It is astonishingly easy to read, honestly. It drags a little in the middle, but the basic premise of this book is that there's a man who works as a real estate agent in southwestern England, and he is dissatisfied with his life, and he has bad family relations, and like everything is going wrong for him. And then he meets a mysterious magical woman who enlists him to help her with a project of magical discovery. And as they work together, he experiences a transformative initiation, meets the goddess face to face, and then comes out sort of stronger and more robust for it. So that's a really interesting book. Again, it's astonishingly easy to read. You do have to like sit through some of the biases of Dionne Fortune as an author. So there are parts of that book that are uncomfortably racist and ableist. But I think the book as itself, or the book itself as a whole, is a really good entry point into working with some of these primary texts. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to read, and there are parts of it that are just beautifully poetic and just absolutely inspired. Yeah. And then, you know, some of these other books, like part of the reason I wrote this book is so that people could get an idea of what those books say without having to sit through 5,000 pages. Because not everyone wants to read the whole of The Golden Bough. Not everyone wants to or should read The White Goddess. The White Goddess is a terrible book. an awful book. Absolutely unreadable. My copy of The White Goddess is full of confused notes in the margins and underlines and pages where I'm just crossing out entire sections because mm-hmm. I don't think what he's saying makes any sense. So some of these books are really rough mm-hmm. and unpleasant, but some of them are actually just great to engage with and really enriching, I think, for any modern practice. And The Gospel of the Witches, I would say, is definitely the best starting point if you're looking to engage directly with some of these texts that have been hugely influential on the development of modern goddess worship.
Yeah. I find it interesting that The White Goddess is such a hot mess because like some of Robert Graves' history writing, like especially like, what is it? The Long Weekend, like England Between the Wars book that he wrote it's like one of my favorite history texts from that time because it's so engaging. And then you're like, clearly that was where you knew what you were talking about. And this was you trying to figure out what you were talking about on the page.
My absolute favorite part of The White Goddess, this is a deranged book. My favorite part of The White Goddess is where he deduces the true and secret ancient name of the goddess. And every other name of any goddess ever has been like a corruption of the original true name of the goddess. Are you ready for this? Yee-ye-oo-wo-wow. He just strings together like seven vowels and he's like, this is the true name of the goddess. You're welcome.
Because that rolls off the tongue in any language.
Absolutely. Yeah. So easy to say.
Yeah. So one of the other things I want to make sure we talk about is the exercises and rituals in this book. Because this really takes us out of this is not your average history book. And I love that the exercises and the rituals both really start with the text that you're talking about in that chapter. So you want to talk about kind of how you developed those or what your thought process was around those?
Yeah. So part of the idea here, again, is that even though history is fun for me, it's not necessarily super fun for everyone. And I wanted to do something with this book that made the material accessible and easy for people to connect to in a variety of ways. So if sitting and reading through explanations of ideas and, you know, the transmission of various historical concepts, if that's not your jam, at the very least, there's some hands-on stuff that you can do that takes all of these abstract concepts and makes them real and concrete and practical. So again, similar to the personal stories that I share at the start of each chapter, there's an idea that what we're talking about here is not just history. It's not just dead in the past. It's something that can come into your current practice and enrich what you're doing. So each chapter has an exercise that puts you in contact with something that is being discussed in the chapter. So in one chapter, I have you make a flying ointment, sort of based on ideas about witchcraft and witches and some of the flying ointments that Margaret Murray talks about as being essential to the practice of the witch cult. In another chapter, I have you collect a series of magical tools that you can use, and, you know, and so on. So each of these chapters has a hands-on thing that you can do that connects you to the material that's being discussed in the chapter. So it's not just, you know, Margaret Murray said that people who were worshiping the goddess did such and such thing. It's like, no, okay, Margaret Murray said that. Now you, currently a worshiper of the goddess, go do that thing and see what it's like. See how it is for you and see if it helps you to connect to the goddess in a meaningful way. And similarly, I have rituals throughout the book that are building on the material in each chapter so that you can take all of these abstract ideas and see what they look like in ritual practice. It's all well and good to say, you know, to read on a page that so-and-so thought that ancient goddess worshippers would have done this. But when you actually do it, when you actually set up a ritual space with an altar and you perform an invocation and you make an offering and you do the thing, it hits you differently. And that was really, really important for me to be able to bring that into practice so that it's not just words on a page. Mm-hmm. And then different people practice differently. Some people are solitary. Some people belong to groups. So each version of the ritual, there is a solo variation and a group variation. So you can do it totally by yourself if you want to, or you can do it with a group of people. But the important thing is that you do something, that it be a practice and not just reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, especially those of us who love to nerd out on stuff, like it's really easy to get in that I'm just going to read about it place and not do the thing. And I think you have to do the thing. I mean, there's just really no way around it. Like if you're going to be a practitioner, you have to practice. It's like, if you're going to be a writer, at some point you actually have to write. So the same thing. Which reminds me, before we get to our game of chance question at the end, I just kind of wanted to talk about you as a writer too. Like, how do you approach writing? Like, what does a good writing day look like for you?
So I think really and truly the hardest part of writing is having something to say. And once you have a clear sense of what you want to say, the rest, at least for me, tends to follow. That's not to say that like writing is the easiest thing in the world, but the hardest thing is just knowing what I want to express. Mm-hmm. And once I have the ideas straight, then putting them on paper tends to follow pretty quickly. So a lot of it goes into outlining. And I spend a lot of time before I start a book project thinking about what the outline is going to look like and how it's going to be structured. I must have gone through at least half a dozen different outlines for this book that were organized in radically different ways, trying to figure out what information I wanted to include, how I wanted to present it, what mattered, like which things did I want to push to the fore. And a lot of earlier drafts of the book really didn't have nearly as much of a historical focus. But as I was sort of toying with the idea of writing a book about the goddess, I kept coming back to the history, because the history was so important to how I understand the goddess. And I kept not liking my outlines because the history felt like it wasn't fitting. And so eventually I scrapped the whole thing and said, okay, let's just organize it around the history, because that's clearly the thing that I actually want to talk about. And so then I figured out how to structure the book around these sort of big, important texts in the history of goddess worship. And once I had that figured out, the rest of it was so much easier to write. Typically, if I'm in full-on book writing mode, I aim for about 1,000 words of writing a day. Mm-hmm. And usually that's doable. Sometimes I'm really in the zone and I'll write more than that. Sometimes I'm really not feeling it and I'll write less than that. But once I have my outline done and I decide to get started on seriously writing, I'm aiming for about 1,000 words a day. Yeah. And a lot of that just has to do with, like, you know, sometimes the ideas are really coming. Sometimes you just have to sit down and force yourself and push through it. And then you can go back and make it better in editing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The make it better in editing thing is, you know, something always important to remember. I will say that I think in reading the book, the I think it, your organization really comes through in reading it. Like, it just feels so cohesive. Like, this is really, and I admire people who can outline because that's not my strong suit. So, I mean, I mostly write fiction, so outlining and fiction obviously is different. But it's such a well organized book, and it's so. I don't know. It was just a pleasure to read how it builds on itself and really talking about it. So good job. I don't know what else. I mean, good job.
Thank you.
A great book.
I'll take it.
Yeah. So before we get to our game of chance, I want to give you an opportunity to tell people where they can find you, what's coming up. And like, we talked a little bit before, and this will come out kind of toward the end of September. So if you want to keep that in mind, if you're, you know, doing anything fun so people don't miss out.
I may be doing something fun, but I don't have anything on the calendar right now. But I am all over the internet. I have a blog that I run, which is Jack of Wands, WANDS, like the suit in the tarot. jackofwandstarot.wordpress.com. I also have a YouTube channel, which you can find just by searching my name, Jack Chanek. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jack_of_wands. And I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/jackofwands. So I'm sort of all over the internet. Usually, if you just Google my name, you can find me. I think I'm the only Jack Chanek out there. So I'm pretty easy to find on an internet search. But yeah.
We'll make sure all that goes in the show notes so people can get to it easier. Great. So our last question, like I said, is a tiny game of chance. And it is, I get the impression that you two may be someone who small talk is not your area of expertise. Like, you just like to get to the interesting stuff. So I'll roll a die, and depending on what I get, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And I do try to kind of relate it to your work or your writing. So it's not 100%, you know, try not to blindside you with something. And if I roll a 6, you get to pick what you want. And if I roll something and you want to say pass, you can, because there are no rules to this game.
Sounds good.
5, money. Oh. So one of in the section on like the rise of like feminist goddess worship in the 70s, you really talk about how the people writing at that time and the people practicing, you know, especially Starhawk and Z Budapest, and really talked about power with rather than power over. And so I thought I would ask you if you personally got to rework our current economic system to focus on power with money, where would you even start? Where would you think about starting with that?
Yeah. So this is an excellent question and is also way above my pay grade. Happy to answer it, but keep in mind that.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, I know you're not an economist, and neither am I. So this is a thought exercise.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, I think a thing that I spend a great deal of time thinking about is how society could be organized around a division of labor that does not collapse into a hierarchical class structure. Mm-hmm. Because we need a division of labor in order to have a functioning civilization. Right. We need to have people who are specialized, who, you know, work on particular things so that each person doesn't have to be doing everything required to keep them alive in terms of, like, growing food and producing textiles and, you know, building furniture. And like, we need to have individual people who are specializing in each of those things. But the second you do that, there are going to be some jobs that are easier than others, some jobs that are more enjoyable than others, some jobs that are easier to take advantage of than others. And it seems like that very quickly striates into a class structure where you have an upper class that is profiting off the work of people who are doing harder or more unpleasant jobs. And so I think a lot of what I would try to come down to would be working on trying to find ways to eliminate that kind of hierarchical class structure. Do I have easy answers as to how to do that? No, not really. I think expanding access to education is a really important thing. And in particular, emphasizing that education is not directly tied to career prospects, that there are benefits in education just for the sake of education, rather than the idea that education has an explicit sort of vocational training purpose. And I think also sort of, expanding social benefits, introducing basic income, and really, like, I'm such a Marxist, so you have to excuse me, but curbing the ability of a person to profit off of work done by someone else is, I think, the quickest way that we can eliminate power over and instead introduce a notion of power with. Yeah. So this is the part where I'm not an expert, and so I don't have concrete solutions to all the world's problems to offer. But I think that really focusing on allowing for a specialization of labor where the people who are performing the labor are the ones who are benefiting the most from it. So if you're, working in a factory, there's not someone who owns that factory who is benefiting from the product being sold when you're just being paid wage labor. Those are the sorts of things that I think would be necessary to think about in order to introduce a real genuine system of power with, as far as the economy goes. Yeah. There are so many details that would have to be hammered out that I lack the experience or expertise to be able to solve, but there's my attempt to answer your question.
No, I love it. And I mean, you don't have to apologize for being a Marxist or anarchist or left thinking economy type person on this show. You're in good company. Let's put it that way. I agree with you that there, I always think it's funny. Like people always say, as you get more conservative, especially around money as you get older. And I was like, I'm ready to become an anarchist swamp witch. Like I have not gotten more conservative as I've gotten older. I see the world differently and realize like, yes, like here's the ideal. Like, how do we get there? Like the getting there part, like you said, is complicated. There's so many steps and so many things to dismantle. And I think one of the things that we have to dismantle is the mindset that this is the way it has to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the first step. I think about, I think it's Ursula K. Le Guin about, people also thought the divine right of kings was invaluable, and look where we are now. So people are really curious why there's an old dude on the throne. So I think we're at the point, and maybe I'm wrong, tell me what you think, that people are really starting to think about this. I don't know that there's as much action as there needs to be, but I feel like the conversations about this is not working are really happening in places they weren't happening before.
Yeah, it's, on the one hand, I see a lot of those conversations being introduced. On the other hand, I don't know, right? Like revolutions are really common throughout history. Like democratic revolutions to equalize economic opportunity, like those are incredibly common throughout history. The problem is that they don't usually stick because it turns out that getting rid of power over is incredibly hard to do because the people who want to hold on to that are very good at finding ways to exploit whatever new thing you put in. And it's very easy for the people who had power to hold on to it in a new form and sort of revert back to the status quo under a new name. So on the one hand, like, I think absolutely those conversations are happening. On the other hand, I worry that the conversation is not going to be a really sincere shift, but that may end up being a little bit of like meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you're right. We have so many examples of that where, you know, the revolutionaries turned into the thing they were fighting in addition to the old people still being in power. So, yeah, I think it's and, you know, revolution is also like the people who suffered the most in revolution are the people who have the least to lose. Right. I mean, they're going to be the most greatly impacted because they are close to the bone already. So I think that's the other thing. Like, revolution is not kind to people struggling in any way, shape or form. So I think that's, you know, the other part of it.
Again, revolutions are incredibly common throughout history, but they are awful, bloody, difficult things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we, especially in the US, where, you know, we have this legacy of the Revolutionary War, we have this habit of glorifying revolution as something that was, like, you know, unilaterally and unquestionably good. And yeah, probably on the net, like, the American Revolution was a good thing, but it came at a really high human cost.
Yeah.
And I think in general, that's a difficult thing to wrestle with, is the idea that drastic change, not even revolution, right? Not even like an overthrow, but, you know, drastic change always has a cost. And it's easy to talk about introducing that drastic change when I am not the one who would be most likely to have to pay that cost.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's important stuff to think about. And I think it's, like, there's no easy answers to this question. There's no easy solution. And we just have to chip away, I think, right now. Like, we're just chipping away, hopefully. And hopefully we have time to do that. like there's things that can have to change pretty rapidly for us to, you know, continue to have air we can breathe. So yeah, there's, you know, I think that may be the great spur to this whole thing, is that, you know, people get tired of, you know, putting out fires and digging out of mudslides and all the stuff coming with that. So, but I would like to end on a happier note. So, what's on the horizon for you writing wise?
So currently I'm just desperately trying to finish my PhD. I'm like within striking distance of defending my dissertation. So that's my top priority right now. Mm-hmm. I do not have another book that's under contract at the moment. I'm just sort of resting on my laurels with Queen of All Witcheries.
I do have resting on your laurels by finishing a PhD. Okay.
Sure. I mean, I have a couple of ideas for things that I would like to put into writing at some point. But those are currently pretty inchoate. So, like, it will take some time before I have another book project come together.
Well, I commend you for getting this book into while you were working on a PhD. That's impressive. And when those things coalesce, let's talk again.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Oh, awesome. Thanks for being on. This was a great conversation, and I hope folks enjoy it.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shanekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.